Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Garrett Broad of Rowan University, and I'm thrilled to be your host for this conversation with Janet Charzan, PhD, a nutritional anthropologist who serves as adjunct assistant professor of nutrition at the University of Pennsylvania. Janet is the author of Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets, along with Kimma Cargill, a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, Tacoma. What makes fad diets so appealing to so many people? And how did these fads become so central to conversations about food and nutrition? These are the key questions that motivate Anxious Eaters, a wide-ranging, engaging, and deeply researched work by our guest today. Janet Charzan, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So to get us started, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your professional background?
Certainly. I'm a nutritional anthropologist, so I'm trained in both nutrition and in anthropology. And within anthropology, I guess you would say I'm a physical or a biological, biocultural anthropologist, and I focus on food. And what I'm interested in is how our social systems channel the foods we eat and how then those foods affect our health. So I ask questions about maternal and child health, for instance. I ask questions that are a little fluffier about, like, how does tourism affect what we eat and our health? What about learning new foods? And other aspects of medical anthropology, such as research in alcohol use.
Interesting. And then this book, Anxious Eaters, how did you come to this project in particular with your co-author, Kimma Cargill?
Well, Kimma and I attend the same conference every year, the Association for the Society of Food, Association for the Study of Food and Society, which is a wonderful conference. And we talk all the time. We did a couple of panels together, and we realized that we were asking a lot of the same questions about food and why we choose food, but we were coming at it from really different perspectives. And so we each had something to bring to the table that would kind of enliven and enlarge our not only the questions we ask, but potentially the kinds of answers that we might come to, that by taking a more cross-disciplinary approach, that we could cover this in a manner that might be a little more realistic, a way of getting at human behavior through a series of lenses.
And you mentioned it's very interdisciplinary. You're all over the place in this book, from psychology and anthropology to nutrition science. So how did you go about bringing all this together? What was the research approach? What was the methodological approach?
Right. What we brought to the table was our own research. So Kimma has done a lot of work on consumerism. She is a Jungian-trained psychologist. And so she's very interested in asking questions about what the human psyche is about and how it's motivated. I am actually a biologist and a nutritionist. And so that I'm always asking questions from my studies in biochemistry. How do foods affect our bodies and our health? But it's very easy to focus on that without understanding how we get food. And so as an anthropologist, I have to look at the systems and the complexes, the economies, and the cultural beliefs and behaviors that bring whatever it's on our plate to our plate that make it acceptable for us to eat. And so that really is multidisciplinary. So I think that's part of probably anthropology as well. I was trained at four-field approach, which definitely comes out in the book.
And let's get to it. The subtitle for the book is Why We Fall for Fad Diets. There are all sorts of dietary practices out there. This book is about fad diets. So what is it that makes a particular dietary practice or a particular diet a fad diet?
Right. So for understanding fad diets, we used the Pennington Biomedical Research Group fad diet definition, which involves seven points. It asks the user to eliminate one or several food groups, promises quick results, such as 5 or more pounds of weight loss a week, uses personal testimonies as proof of effectiveness, use only certain or special foods that claim to offer advantages for weight loss, recommend supplements or pills, are endorsed or advertised by a celebrity, and usually do sound too good to be true. And I can boil this down to makes improbable claims about efficacy and asks you to change your food rituals. You're being asked to buy something different or special as a means of enhancing your health or losing weight or whatever your goal might be. So ultimately, a fad diet is something that asks you to change what you're eating in order to, I think, reach a goal that might not be directly connected to that particular food.
Mm-hmm. And as you noted, too, the sort of celebrity and media culture part of this, that seems to be central, but is it sort of a big part of it, but not necessarily necessary to have that kind of, because a lot of times when I think of fad, I'm also thinking of the mediated aspect. Somebody's making a lot of money off of this as well. It's being marketed. So does a fad diet have to be marketed in that way through media and celebrity, or are there examples of fad diets that maybe don't have that media marketing apparatus behind it?
No, I would absolutely say that there has to be some marketing, and because these are driven. If you read them, and we read so many books and interviewed a lot of people. If you read these books, they are clearly, they are designed to be marketing behemoths. And you can see that definitely in things like the Whole 30 or the Atkins Empire. And all of this comes back to the original fad diet, William Banting in the 1850s, I think, who advocated for a low carbohydrate diet based on recommendations from his doctor. And he did indeed have type 2 diabetes. And so this helped him. And he went on to self-publish and to use a lot of self-testimonies to create the Banting diet. And for a long time, if you were dieting, you weren't dieting, you were doing Banting. And I think that, and these diets keep cycling back to kind of that same trajectory. So it's hard for me to think of a fad diet that doesn't have somebody's name attached to it. Atkins, the Wall Protocol, the Whole 30. Okay, that's maybe a little different. But it has some kind of a name that's easily identifiable and marketable.
As you mentioned, there's so many different diets that are featured in this book, and it sounds like you just spent years and years reading through all these different, you know, books and cookbooks and websites and things like that. But you note in the book that while all of these fad diets, they might appear radically different on the surface. You might have some saying, you know, cut out all meat, and you might have others saying eat only meat and everything in between. You argue that despite these radical differences, they're all driven by the same engine. So let's start there. What is that engine? What is the same engine?
Right. Self-transformation. And that's something that is particularly powerful, we believe, in the United States. We have a lot of narratives about transforming the self, rags to riches. Kim is particularly interested in how consumerism is tied in with these stories of self-transformation and rags to riches, that by buying something you can improve. A lot of times these fad diets, part of the self-transformation I've noticed, is also rooted in either a desire to be healthy or a fear of food that might create a system in which you're not healthy. So a lot of the narratives about these fad diets are really triggering fears that if you don't utilize a certain protocol, that you could be in danger. But we grouped the fad diets into the various bunches that we did, and other people might group them very differently because we felt that they had some kind of epistemological connection. Mm-hmm. So obviously food removal diets, they remove a macronutrient or something that's assumed to be a macronutrient. Like most people think gluten is a carbohydrate. It's not. It's a protein. But a food removal diet is not something like vegetarianism or veganism. Those are food process diets, and actually they're not fad diets at all, really. They might act like a fad diet if your 14-year-old comes home and decides to be a vegan and throws the household into turmoil because his or her or their friends are doing this. But these are deep-seated practices that are far more comprehensive and systemic than simply a food removal or a carbohydrate or protein.
Come back to that. So you said it's a process diet as opposed to a fad diet. Is that the term you used?
I would say that, and
mean? What is a process diet?
To me, it means that you're engaging with the food system processes in a particular kind of way. So you are abjuring meat, for instance, if you're a vegetarian, because you believe that the processes usually of meat production might be harmful to the animals, which they most certainly are, or harmful to yourself, or harmful to other ecological systems. For this is the same rationale that goes into a lot of veganism, I think. But it's outside. It's the context of that practice rather than the essential nutritionism, which, to use a phrase that hopefully we understand, that is that idea that you're going to essentialize a food into some component that we think has a critical role to play in it. So bread is a carbohydrate. Yeah.
That was Skrinis's term that Pollan popularized. And I think that's interesting in terms of I think one of the things you demonstrate in this book is this compassion throughout, even as you're being deeply critical of them and trying to understand the logic in all of these diets. So, you know, before you were talking about they're all kind of driven by the same engine, this promise of self-transformation that you offer a lot of critiques of, but you say that these diets make sense. They make a kind of sense, I should say. So how do these things that you think, people think carbohydrates are this, or people, you know, get this wrong about this food removal diet, or as we'll get into some of the really wacky things, how do they make sense when there's a lot of wackiness and a lot of, as you also talk about, things like pseudoscience?
Well, most of them don't make any biological sense whatsoever, but they make social sense. They make cultural sense. And that's because they use cultural narratives that we already accept about, for instance, health or identity or self-transformation or how to be a good citizen. They play on those narratives in such a way that they make a lot of cultural sense. So food addiction, for instance, comes directly from the models that we have about alcohol and other forms of like opiate addiction. And it uses the same narratives, it uses the same stories. And that tells me that those stories are very important to our culture. They might not be quite so important in other cultures, but to our culture, that's a deeply normative and a deeply meaningful way of understanding the world. So as an anthropologist, of course we have to, and I would say as a psychologist for Kimma, we have to bring compassion to the table because it's not really about the food. It's about a whole series of other things and a series of motivations that are getting at how people feel about themselves. And so while their practices might sound kooky, if you're a nutritionist, I recognize that the people who are practicing those things are worried about something.
Mm-hmm. So throughout the book, the book is really separated into these different sections. As you know, you found these categories, even as there's some diversity in some of these diets. So I'd love to go through some of these. You've already mentioned a few of them, but would love to drill down just a little bit more into a few of them. So we're going to talk about food removal diets. We're going to talk about food addiction. We're going to talk about clean eating, among others. But let's return to the food removal diet, because that's a big one. We see this, you say, you know, kind of most diets have some element of food removal coming to them. And you're very critical, not just of some of the lack of logic when it comes to the nutritional side, but also the social side. So what do you see as the social costs of food removal diet fads?
Yeah. Well, the social cost, I think, is quite obvious. As an anthropologist, I'm about social systems. It's important that we eat together. That's actually what my research is about. And it's really hard to eat with other people if you have removed a macronutrient from your diet. It is really hard to sit down at a Thanksgiving table and abjure all grain, or if you have gone completely keto. And it's very hard to go out and have a dinner with someone and to participate in social rituals if your diet becomes so restricted that you cannot really get something off a menu. If you can't eat at Granny's house, right? Because Granny's cooking things that you are afraid of or you want to avoid. It's very hard for Granny to understand, but it's also very hard for you to be a family member. So this is why many of these diets, people will adopt them for a little while. In many cases, they feel better because sometimes they're eliminating foods that might make them feel not so good, like eating a lot of processed foods in place of whole foods. If you replace that with things with lots of fiber, you're going to feel better. But it's very hard as time goes by if you want to be social. And there's significant research that demonstrates that. And it's really within a 6 months to 12 month period. If you take it out to 18 months, you see that people, most of the research, not my research, but what we reviewed, that most people really have a hard time keeping these things going.
Until they move on to the next one, right? Because
yes.
that's also a big part of what you talk about is how, you know, we all know those folks. Maybe some of our listeners are those folks. And again, we want to be compassionate towards everybody here. But, you know, I'm keto today. And then 3 months from now, I'm doing something completely different. And, oh, I'm off gluten now and I'm off this. Why do you think there is that kind of jumping from diet to diet? And it seems like food removal diets, maybe in particular, have this kind of trendiness to them for folks.
Yeah. This is a conversation Kim and I had so many times, and so much of this book really was about the two of us talking over the course of many years. I think that we're primed to believe that restriction is good. Kimma would say it's the Protestant ethic, this asceticism that is a part of Christianity. I don't know. It's as a food anthropologist, I think it's part of other religious systems as well. But I think Kimma would argue, and I think I would probably agree, that we do carry this to an extreme, that the Protestant work ethic and this idea that by giving things up, you are going to prevail, that you're going to be better, that you're going to improve yourself, that you're going to be a better person, that you're going to get into heaven better or something, is maybe something that Americans believe or can believe a little better than others. I don't know. I wouldn't stake my profession on that, but it seems to me that it's a kind of underlying value in the United States. So giving things up is good. And so it must be good for us if we give things up. And therefore, a diet that asks us to give things up is probably a good diet because it'll be good for us. It becomes very circular.
But so that means if, you know, if I didn't achieve that social transformation by giving up gluten, maybe that enlightenment will come if I give up other processed foods, or if I give up meat, or if I give up something else.
Absolutely. You've nailed it. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting too, right? I think there are a lot of folks who kind of sample religions in a somewhat similar way, or maybe sample, you know, professional pursuits. So as you've kind of, you know, already noted that this isn't just about a food exploration through food, it's using food as this tool for self-exploration, for self-enlightenment or the goals of enlightenment.
Yeah, one of the things that we state at the beginning of the book, and that really was the wind in our sails, is that we're focusing not on the content of the diet, but on the context of the diet. It's not a diet book, because that wouldn't really be appropriate, and Columbia certainly didn't want something like that. We just really wanted to work our way around each of those diets, asking questions about, you know, what does this diet do for people? And obviously, I do write a little bit about the nutritional aspect, because we can't step away from that, but that's not the focus of the book.
And you've already mentioned a little bit the language of food addiction, but would love to return to that and hear a little bit more about that. You think maybe there's something about the kind of American psyche around addiction specifically, but this comes up so much. What is it about addiction that it's such a prominent frame? And it seems like something that in your writing that a lot of folks feel almost relieved to feel like they have an addiction in a kind of paradoxical way.
Yeah, and I think I might have been a little primed to think through addiction because I taught a harm reduction class on alcohol at Penn for well over a decade, and I ended up writing a book, was it Social Drinking and Cultural Context, that came out about a decade ago. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about addiction, interviewing a lot of people in recovery, and doing a lot of cultural analysis of what addiction and the addiction narrative looks like in the United States. And it's, again, it's a self-transformative narrative that's deeply embedded in how I think we think about ourselves, because the AA model, Alcoholics Anonymous model, says that you're going to hit bottom and then you're going to change. And with the help of AA and giving up alcohol and the help of your 12-step program and the people involved, because they're very important, that you're going to turn around, and it's like a Horatio Alger story, that you're going to then return to economic and social success and good citizenship. You're going to, again, be an exemplar of your culture. And I think that narrative is very powerful. And the stories that surround AA are very powerful, and they obviously work for a lot of people, which is wonderful. And so it makes perfect sense that people would then adopt that language to talk about food desires and urges. And I've read the big book, the AA big book, and the big book for NA. And then I read the big books, Food Addictions Anonymous and Food Addicts Anonymous. There's a number of different spin-off groups for food. And what struck me, having read all the AA literature deeply and multiple times, was how much it absolutely mirrored the language. The stories were the same. If you could you could take out, you know, wheat or a baguette and put in alcohol, and it was the exact same story that you read in the big book. And so that tells me that there's something really important culturally that's going on there, that is a narrative that's deeply resonant in our society.
But is it addiction? Because that was a very interesting, I thought, in the book, that you and your co-author were quite open in several parts, but I think specifically in this part, about maybe not being 100% on the same page in terms of your conclusions. So could you talk to us about whether you think food addiction is a real addiction? And tell us a little bit about how that kind of maybe, I don't want to say disagreement, but somewhat difference of interpretation played out between you and your co-author.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We had a lot of fun with this. Food addiction is really complicated. First and foremost, no, you're not addicted to carbohydrates. We absolutely have to have carbohydrates. Glucose fuels the brain. Without glucose, your brain shuts down. We need carbohydrates. And there's really not a lot of evidence that any of the basic chemical constituents of basic food has any addictive qualities whatsoever. They do simply do not bang the receptor drums that alcohol and opioids do in the brain. I mean, there's very specific receptors that respond to alcohol and opioids and other of those very well-known addictive substances. We know how that process works. Food simply doesn't work that way. Now, to put on a medical anthropology hat, however, we acknowledge that we live in our bodies and we have this embodied reality. And so I would say, as a medical anthropologist, that if you believe you have an addiction to something, you are going to behave as if you have an addiction to something. And therefore, you are indeed addicted to that thing, even if there's no biological addiction the way that you might be to alcohol or opioids. So that's kind of a very fine line there, because I'm saying, A, no, you're not addicted, but B, you are mentally addicted. And so there's psychological work that really classifies food addiction as a behavioral addiction. You're addicted to eating, not addicted to any of the nutrients. And that's interesting, because when you read the books and talk to people who have what they term food addiction, they see themselves as addicted to an essentialized nutrient within the food. So they don't see themselves as having an eating addiction. They see themselves having a substance addiction.
I'm addicted to sugar. I'm addicted to carbs or bread or whatever.
Right. And that, you know, I'm not going to tell them they're not physically, biophysically, but they have an addiction process the same way people might be addicted to gambling, you know. And I think that there is some interesting research coming out about highly processed foods and how those seem to bang some drums, not necessarily the same addiction drums, but that they bang some desire drums in a way that want you to eat more and more and more. Now, Kimma started off believing very strongly that we were addicted to highly processed foods. And then in the course of doing the reading for this, she, I think, changed her mind. That, you know, even the concept of an eating addiction is rather problematic. And so we just agreed to disagree, you know. And that's fine, because I really think that there's a lot more work to be done on this topic. And, you know, it might turn out that there are chemicals, highly processed chemicals in food, that do indeed create some kind of an addiction response. I don't know. I'm not doing that research, but I think that there are people that are trying to find that out. And on the other hand, I could certainly argue that there's the potential for an eating addiction, a psychological eating addiction. But from the medical anthropology standpoint, if somebody says they're addicted, I have to really listen to them and believe them. And as you so kindly put it, have the compassion to hear where they're coming from and recognize it as real to them.
Just as a little bit of a sidebar, I think, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are writers and authors and maybe have thought about or have engaged in co-authoring and collaborating. What is it like when you said, you know, we had fun with it and we agreed to disagree, but, you know, how do you come to a sort of consensus about how you're going to approach a topic like this where there is some difference of interpretation?
Well, we wrote slightly different sections and then decided to meld them, you know, and it's kind of come together at the end of that chapter and just lay it out that we really saw this rather differently. But I think that that also represents the state of the science. And so that's okay. You know, she was reading a set of literatures from her field. I read some of it. And I was reading a set of literatures from other fields. And then, of course, in medical anthropology, again, we have to go back to that emic perspective that somebody feels that they're addicted, they have a problem, they're going to behave as if they are. You know, I think the research about priming behavior is pretty clear. If you, for instance, like chocolate, and I were to say to you, well, I'm a nutritionist, and I happen to know that most people who like chocolate are actually addicted to chocolate and can't stop eating chocolate. The next time you enjoy that piece of chocolate, that's going to run through your head, and you might say, oh my gosh, I can't stop eating this. Whereas in reality, you're perfectly capable of putting the chocolate bar down. So once again, when you look at the context of these things, I think you come up with a set of behavioral patterns that might be indicative of a real problem.
Great. Yeah.
So I hope that makes sense.
No, definitely. Definitely. And I think, as you note, there's a lot, I think, still to be explored, as well as just some fundamental differences in definition, right, around a term like addiction. You know, there is the strict biomedical definition, and then there is the, you know, historian and sociology and anthropology of science definition. And I think they both have value, but I think it's useful to be very clear about how are we employing that term in a given moment. And I think that's something that you folks do a nice job of in the book.
Thank you.
Please,
one of the things that came to mind, and I'm forgetting the name of the fellow who wrote a very informative article, the concept of habituation. It used to be that in the United States, people believed that you were habituated to being drunk. You weren't addicted to alcohol. You were habituated. You liked being drunk, so you kept doing it. And again, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the very excellent article that this was about. It was written some time ago. But I think that might be one way to think about food addiction, is that it as a habituation process. I don't know if others would agree, but given my background research in alcohol, it made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. So great. So continuing to look at some of the specific chapters and categories you looked at, I was really drawn to the clean eating chapter, having done a little bit of work looking at some of these trends myself. And so let's start with some basic definitions. What does it mean to eat clean? And what does that desire for cleanliness really represent?
You're getting to the core of it. I don't think, as I said in the book, I don't think there's really any tremendously good definition of clean, which is why it's so valuable, because you can stick that word on any product that you're selling. And so whoever sees that, they're going to take it as they understand clean and buy your product. It is a very, very wifty concept. And even the Clean Eating magazine and all of the various books that I read, they have different definitions. And over time, it's become more stringent, as most of these diets have. But I think most people would say that it's eating food that's whole, maybe food that's doesn't have stuff in it. That kind of comes back again and again. I did research on organics eaters, and this overwhelming fear of what might be in your food. And so I think part of what drives clean is this idea that there's stuff in the food that's going to hurt us, which may or may not be true, right? If we avoid that stuff that might hurt us, that will be clean. And clean, of course, is a very powerful word socially. Right? It's a very dichotomizing word. Something is either clean or it's dirty. And so rather than having a spectrum, which most things are on, as we know, it allows you to epistemologically batch stuff, food, in your head in a way that gives you a kind of moral superiority as long as you're eating whatever it is you think that's clean. And I think your idea of clean might be different than my idea of clean. I don't know.
It does seem like the clean eating fad is particularly marketable. And could you talk a little bit about what you saw in your work around, you know, who are the sort of big voices of clean eating and what does that tell us? Any particular examples or celebrities or spokespersons that you think stick out and really represent things?
Well, we can't get away from Gwyneth Paltrow.
All right. I didn't want to say Goop, but talk about Goop. Tell us about Goop and Goop's relevance here.
Well, and actually, Columbia has a very complicated peer review process. I've never been peer reviewed as much as I was by them. They did a phenomenal job and had really good reviewers. But one of the reviewers made me rewrite the section on Gwyneth. I was a little harsh, apparently. I think that besides Goop and the set of products that Goop retails. The Goop shopping site online is a stunning thing to view. You also see clean coming up as a concept with a lot of other diets. So Whole30 and the Hartwigs come to mind, because the Whole30 diet has simply taken a whole bunch of other diets, Atkins and little bits and bobs from the South Beach diet and the Wall Protocol and Gundry, and smooshed them all together and said to people, well, give up all of this food that's dirty for 30 days and you'll feel better. So that has become, I think, this idea that clean is something that you give up things. I mean, Goop has a 30-day detox every January where they provide a set of foods that you're not supposed to eat. And if you go into the archives of Goop, you find that those foods have become more and more restrictive as the time has come forward. So, and the latest cookbook that I reviewed for this volume that was written by Gwyneth Paltrow really makes it clear that there was no meat, there was no alcohol, there was no wheat, there was no this, there was no that. And I was thinking, oh my God, you've taken away joy in life, you know? and because it was very clean, and the graphics were very clean. They were white, they were light, they were whole foods. And whole vegetables. So I don't know that I can be really clear about clean, because I think that it really becomes something that is meaningful based on the individual hearing it.
How much of this is really about thinness, and how much of the clean eating fad? It just seems like there's so much overlap with potential for disordered eating, with fat stigma, with fat phobia. Talk to me a little bit about that. How can I make sense of, is clean eating just a way for people to get thin and put a kind of moral valence to that? Obviously, that doesn't have to be the only thing there, but it seems like there's a whole lot of fat stigma, fat shaming, fat phobia that's central to the clean eating trend in particular.
Yeah. And I think that clean eating trend is part of the wellness trend. And the wellness trend, as many people have published, is really the second generation of it's good to be thin, without saying thin, because now that's considered rather socially unacceptable to be advocating for the thin body when we have health at every size, which of course is a great movement, and one can be healthy at every size. So one is supposed to stay away from fat phobia. But of course it is. And I think one of the best writers on this is Lindy West, who did just a brilliant set of analyses and very approachable in their online essays about Goop and wellness. And her perspective, she's so brilliant, such a great writer. And I found her perspective to be just so valuable. One of the things that she pointed out that comes up again and again with these diets is that they're very expensive. And eating clean is extremely expensive. So it's really because it's whole ingredients, often specific kinds of whole ingredients, organic whole ingredients. And there's generally organic foods are more expensive than conventionally raised foods. And then there's a lot of whole foods that take a lot of time. So they're not only expensive in terms of monetary cost, but they're extremely expensive in terms of time cost. And so really the only people who can do these are the folks with time and folks with money, who tend to be the privileged. And the privileged also tend to be thinner already, right? They tend to be healthier because, well, they have really good healthcare usually because they're privileged. And so this all, as you say, adds a moral valence to social class. And that's one of the core problems. Is it about thinness? Absolutely. But are we allowed to say it's about thinness? Are the advocates saying it's about thinness? No, they're saying it's about health. They're saying it about living your best life or living up to your potential.
Or living to 100 and, you know, the optimization
Absolutely.
Has become the kind of dominant language in a lot of these spaces. You've mentioned a couple of times organic as part of this, and also write about non-GMO food consumption. You call them sort of a first step into the clean eating trend. What's going on there? What makes organic, non-GMO so prominent in clean eating?
Yeah. Well, this comes from a couple things, a lot of it having to do with conversations I've had with people. In 2007, I started a farmer's market outside of Philadelphia. It's a not-for-profit, and I'm no longer on the board, but I can tell you it's still an excellent farmer's market with really great board members. So, but over the course of now however many years, I have had so many conversations with customers, with producers, with farmers, about organics and about why particular customers choose whatever foods that they might be choosing. And then as a nutritionist, of course, I have to hear what people are saying about their food choices. And one of the things that I find absolutely terrifyingly sad is just how afraid of food people are. And that so much of the desire for organics and non-GMO is not systemic. It's not about the context. It's not about the health of plants or animals or the ecosystem, which is my desire for perhaps purchasing those goods. But it is about a deep-seated fear of what's in the food and how it might hurt you. That there's an incredible pollutant in the food, that something in the food, and this is of course a very, very deep-seated, primordial fear, right? We're primates and we're omnivores, and so from the earliest times of our omnivorous life, we have to figure out what's not going to poison us. And so I think that this fear is very, in some ways, rational, but it's been truly monetized by, I think, some of the clean eating advocates. I was shocked when I queried and did a lot of interviews and various questionnaires on motivations for organic purchases, and found that what I had expected to find was a concern for the environment, because that was my concern. And that's also a concern in a lot of Germany and some other places where the research has been done. And what I found instead was very little concern about the environment. I got an enormous amount of concern about avoiding bad things in food.
Cancer. People say cancer specifically.
Cancer, yes, or sickness or whatever. I had people who say they've eaten organic for decades say to me, "Oh, I don't care about the environment. It doesn't really matter." And I'm thinking, "Oh my goodness gracious!" But yes, it does. And so I was absolutely struck by some of these responses that, to me, as a farming advocate and as a somebody who studied biochemistry and nutrition, just didn't make sense. Because if you have a healthy environment, a healthy ecosystem, you have healthy animals and healthy plants, you'll have healthy food. And so that's the organic nexus for me, but that's not the organic nexus for most of the people I talk to.
Yeah, it's such an interesting tension. And it's something that I really must say, as I was reading this, I was really identifying, because this is balancing these two thoughts is something I've really struggled to do, which is, on one hand, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to critique, call it big ag, call it industrial food, right? About the problems of eating too much unhealthy processed foods, about the environmental problems of the food system as we know it, certainly about the ethical problems when it comes to treatment of animals and workers and others. So we've got that, right? We agree with a lot of that is often coming out in these clean eating books as they're railing against the food system as we know it. But then a lot of these same critics are spouting, you know, what you refer to, and I would agree, is pseudoscience, you know, that is harmful, and that is, you know, just empirically wrong, and that can be sometimes really directly exploitative of people, of their wallets, and of their minds, and of their mental health and well-being. So what do we do here? You know, what do we do as those of us who, you know, think, hey, there's a good reason to want to change fundamental aspects of our food system to promote, you know, eating more healthy and more whole foods in certain ways, but also not falling into some of these traps of sort of this pseudoscientific bunk. How do you deal with that? And maybe you don't have a single answer there, but how have you thought through that? And what can those who find themselves in a similar bind to us do with that?
Yeah. In this situation, I think knowledge really is power. When I was confronted, and the producers, the farmers at the farmers market were confronted by somebody who was asking questions, and I give some of these narratives in the book about, well, how do you farm? What's in the food? What's in the food? And the farmer has no idea how to answer to that, because the farmer is doing a process that's very different than what's in the food. And so I would try to mediate, but one of the things that I tried to advocate for that the consumers would ask the farmers is, tell me how you farm, right? Tell me the system. How is it that you are farming, rather than are there chemicals in this food? Because the farmer's answer to that is, yeah, there's nutrition in that food. There's chemicals, you know, it's made up of chemicals. Are you asking me if I put chemicals on, you know? And so
it, you talk about sprays is another one. People, did you spray this? And they're like, well, yes, but we spray it with certain things and other. And then there was someone in the book who I think said, no sprays. You're sickening people. You're poisoning people.
Right. When I ask people, what does organic mean? Most of the time they can't answer. Even people who are allegedly organic buyers. And so that really bothers me, because I think organics is a good idea, again, because of the health of farm workers and the health of the ecosystem. Recently, we've come to understand body burden. And, you know, this is relatively new research. So now we have another reason to, particularly for our children, to feed organics if we can afford them. That's the problem, because it does seem to decrease body burden. But most importantly, I think it decreases the burden on our ecosystem, and it makes sure that our farmers are healthier.
Can you just say body burden? That might not be a term folks are familiar with. What is that?
Breakdown metabolites from food that has indeed been treated with various kinds of chemicals. And some of the research that started really being published 10, 15 years ago showed that if you took kids or other people off of processed foods and off of and onto an organic diet, that the some of these breakdown metabolites, don't ask me what they are because I don't remember, are cleared out of the bloodstream. So again, we don't know what the downstream of that. We don't know if those are good or bad. But this idea that we may be encouraging some kind of a body burden. Now, the problem with the organics buying and clean eating is that it takes what is an ecological and social and economic problem and turns it into an individual solution. Obviously SAS has done a very good work on, what is it, Shopping Our Way to Happiness or something. I've forgotten the name of his excellent book. Shopping Our Way to Safety, I think, which is this inverted quarantine that rather than getting involved in ensuring that our politicians keep our environment clean, thus making our food clean, we disengage with the social world and the political world, but then we hyper focus on our own, on what comes into the house. And of course, this is terrible in many ways because it's not solving the problem, but it's also a solution that might only be open to those who are economically advantaged. And yet we give it, as you say, a lot of moral valence. You're a good person if you eat organics. Well, what if you need to make $150,000 a year to eat organics? And that's only the top quintile of U.S. Workers. So it leaves a lot of people out of being a good citizen, right? Or a good food citizen. But again, it's also not addressing the core problem, which is that this is an environmental problem that all of us together, working together, need to solve.
And then on the other side of things, sort of in a kind of photo negative in certain ways of the clean eating, you have paleo. And you know, if there's Goop as the kind of patron saint of clean eating, you know, maybe it's Joe Rogan or somebody like that who might be the patron saint of paleo. You mentioned several other folks. I think you talked about Mike Cernovich a bunch in your book. What is paleo? Where did it come from? And then we can talk a little bit about what does it have to do with toxic masculinity, a term you use frequently in the book. But what is paleo? Because it's not one thing, right? What is paleo and what are some of the roots of paleo?
Yeah, kind of like clean. Paleo is an imagined past, right? It is very much an imagined past, imagined by our current values and what we currently give importance to. I have taught Paleolithic nutrition. It looks nothing like the paleo diet.
And why not? What is it about the real Paleolithic nutrition that's different from what we call paleo?
Because we're omnivores. We eat everything that we can possibly eat in the environment, and we have historically. And if we look at the evidence that we now have about what Neanderthals were eating, what our hominin ancestors were eating, it is very clear, using good science, teeth analysis, bone analysis, coprolite, my favorite analysis, that if you go back, you find that yes, indeed, people are eating grains. They're wild grains, or they're eating all kinds of tubers. They're eating whatever they can in the environment. We are omnivores, and we have evolved out of fruit-eating primates. So the fact that we eat meat is because we got bigger brains than those fruit-eating primates, and we're better at hunting it down. It is an evolutionary advantage because it provides things that we need to grow our brains, right? So it's a good thing for us to eat, although one can eat in a perfectly healthy manner as a vegetarian. You don't have to have meat to grow a brain. So the paleo diet, again, because we're an omnivore, every subspecies of remains that we find had a diet that was determined by its ecological system rather than an innate human needs. We are omnivores. We're not like pandas. I think, what do they eat, eucalyptus or something? Yeah, is it eucalyptus? Okay, we're not pandas. If it moves, we can eat it, pretty much. And our primary job is to figure out what won't kill us and then eat that. And so the paleo diet was first, the idea of the Paleolithic prescription, a book from 1988, actually quite a good book, Eaton, Boyd, and Connor, a medical doctor, and two anthropologists, biocultural, biological anthropologists, I believe, and looking at constructing a thought exercise on what we might have eaten as hunter-gatherers, using extant current hunter-gatherer groups as a way of analyzing their diets to sort of just point to. It's not definitive, it's a pointing to. And it found some really interesting things. Guess what? A lot less sodium, a lot more potassium. It didn't find that people were eating meat and nothing but meat. On the contrary, it found that meat and meat-related foods were about 35%, depending upon the ecological system. So it plays a role, but not a critical role. However, that's not a book that is necessarily referenced enough by paleo advocates. And they tend to go back to this idea, what was it, Vladimir Stefanson from the 1930s, Weston Price, also publishing in the 1930s, and a series of other writers. I think we can trace this one back to Banting as well, that are really playing on the cultural notion, the social notion that meat is good. We really value meat, you know, the roast beef of England. Americans eat a lot more meat than most of the rest of the people in the world. We eat meat three times a day sometimes, which is insane, really, in comparison with our historical diet and our even our Paleolithic diet. So this is a cultural value that meat is important. And I think it was driven by the fact that it's really hard to find the archaeological remains of non-bone foods. So grains dissolve. It's hard to find it in the archaeological record. But what you know is what's left behind is the mastodon bone that has evidence of meat being sliced off. And so for people who don't delve deeply into the science, it's easy to think that, well, bones are what's there, therefore they only ate what was attached to bones, and therefore we only ate meat.
But unlike so many of the other diets you discuss in this book, men are really at the center here. So is that fair to say that men and masculinity and narratives of masculinity are really at the center? Obviously not the whole of that movement, but at the center of it. So what do you think is so attractive to men among this, this big menu of potential diets to choose from? Why is it that is the one that's resonated so much with certain spheres of men, maybe men online in particular?
Oh boy, yes. Well, because meat is made up of muscle and men want to be muscly.
Therefore I am. I eat meat, therefore I am muscle.
Exactly. And so this narrative that if you want to grow your muscles and be a big man, be a dominant man, right? You can dominate other men. And of course, women have access to mating opportunities, as we say in biology. It's better to be big. It's better to have those muscles. How do you build those muscles? Well, you lift weights and you eat meat. And so that's really, I think, a big part of it. It's very reductive. But then if you read Chernovich, Devaney, and their folks, you find that there is attached to meat a set of cultural values. They believe that men eat meat and that it allows them, because they're dominating the animal and they're bigger and they're stronger, it is the essential thing if you're going to be a winner, if you're going to be a male who is in power. I'm trying to pick my words here very carefully. But a man, because to them, I think, in reading through much of these blogs and listening to some of this stuff, they identify masculinity with the right to dominate. And that's scary. I mean, I was very cranky when I was doing the background research for that. And my husband, who is a very nice man, said, "When are you going to finish writing that chapter, please?"
Yeah, it is interesting. I will say, reading the book, it was the chapter where you folks got a little more actively political and a little more actively, I don't want to say you lost the kind of compassion that you had in other sections, but there was a higher level of kind of cultural concern even about the people behind this and what their kind of cultural attachments and cultural motives were. It seemed that way, at least.
Yeah, and I've forgotten the name of the author, but there's a wonderful book called Paleo Fantasy, written by a biologist. And I think that she lays out really quite brilliantly some of the thought exercises that lead to the acceptance of this paleo diet and how it really just reverberates and reiterates some of the fantasies and the insecurities that people have, particularly men. Now, obviously, there are a lot of women that are interested in paleo, and I find that there was a real community online of women who were interested in paleo because they wanted to be healthier and they wanted to make sure that their families were healthier. So this narrative that, you're eating this food that our species was meant to eat, and therefore we would be healthy, and my children will be healthy, and I will be healthy. It was more of the narrative that you see in some of these, particularly the cookbooks, the family-friendly paleo cookbooks. If you go online and read some of these male advocates, it's just a cornerstone. I mean, you're some kind of a sissy boy if you are eating anything other than a very profound red meat diet.
Yes, of course, the soy boys. And that was Marlene Zook, I believe, is the paleo fantasy. So moving towards a landing here, this has been such a wonderful conversation. And I want to move to a question that you noted earlier on in this conversation that this book is not about telling people what to eat, but I am sure that you are constantly asked, what should people eat? What should I eat? You know, whether at the farmer's market or the grocery store or at a book talk or whatever it is. So I'm not going to ask you to tell me what we should eat, but I'm actually more interested in how do you respond when people, I assume people ask you how should they eat? So how do you respond to that question?
Well, as a nutritionist, this is actually what I am interested in driving, a better diet. The easy answer, I think, is that the Mediterranean diet has been shown to have some significant health consequences, very positive ones. And derived from the Mediterranean diet, you have the DASH diet, which is a hypertension diet, and the MIND diet, which is to increase cognitive potential or to decrease the potential for dementia. The Mediterranean diet is a diet that allows you to eat pretty much with your friends and family all the time. But what it does is it emphasizes eating whole foods, right? And in particular, decreasing amounts of some processed foods, decreasing amounts of red meat and red meat fat. Doesn't take them out of the diet, which is what's important. All things in moderation. But it shifts you towards whole grains. Number of foods that we know are anti-inflammatory, whole vegetables, the olive oils, etc. It's also, I think it is easy to follow. The one thing that I would also say is that we tend to essentialize nutritionism, as you mentioned, Jorgi Skrinis's work. And I would say as a nutritionist that that's not a good way to think about it. Think about not the food that you're eating, but think about it over the course of a day or a week. So that it might be that you go to a birthday party and you enjoy that piece of chocolate cake. Well, that's a once in a while food, a party food. Enjoy it, right? It's going to make you happy to enjoy it. But recognize that maybe the next day you're not going to eat chocolate cake or you're not going to have the potato chips. It's always about portion size and frequency. And so if you can just shift your diet into more whole foods, particularly foods with fiber, they do a lot of good things in our body. Not only do they have connections with increased serotonin for better mental health, but they improve the microbiome of the gut, which has significant consequences. We're really only starting to understand to our overall health. We evolved eating a lot more fiber. We know that because hominins have teeth that are kind of ground down from eating fiber. So we don't have pointy little canines like wolves. We really did not evolve eating nothing but meat. We need fiber. And we just don't, most Americans don't get enough fiber. And so that is becoming a critical issue. And I would say that, drink more water. When people ask me what they should do, I say, really, I don't want you to drink any soda pop or any even sugar-free soda pop unless it's like a party food. You know, you have your everyday foods, your once-a-week foods, your once-in-a-while foods, your party food. It's better to avoid those kinds of foods because it really is just empty calories that can have negative long-term consequences to overstimulating the insulin response. So, lots of fiber, a balanced diet, enjoy your food with other people, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're not going to make a lot of money selling that diet. So, but you've really enriched our understanding here in this conversation through writing this book. So I'll finish with our traditional New Books Network final question, which is, what are you working on or what are you thinking about these days?
Yeah. I have something in the pipeline. I'm just starting. Like many academics, I never really did enough with my doctoral dissertation. And it was on social eating and how it affects maternal and child health. But a lot of the work that I've done asks the question, how does eating together affect our health? And so I am very interested in writing a monograph going forward that I'm outlining now on how social eating. And I'm going to call it something like the sharing instinct, because we have evolved as human beings because we have this richer diet, partly due potentially to meat, of course, but also a lot of other things that in our omnivorous environment we eat. But we also evolve as human beings because we, unlike other primates, feed our children after weaning. So we have baked into our genes sharing food. And so I really want to go forward and explore not only a little more publishable aspect of my own research, but explore what other people have done in more detail about sharing food.
Well, Janet Charzan is the author, along with Kimma Cargill, of Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, and really appreciate you taking the time and doing this important work to help us better understand why we're all so anxious and what we can do better to understand our food environment. Thank you so much, Janet.
Garrett, thank you. These were great questions, and I really appreciate being on the show.